You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā katoa, ko Jemima Houston, tōku ingoa, no mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Thursday the 26th of August. My name is Jemima and I'm your host because we're in level 4 lockdown and I am holding the reins for the news team here while people are working diligently at home to bring you the latest in news and current events. Connor has been producing the show today from home, which is an awesome feat, and I just like to give a huge shout out to people for doing that because it is amazing, and I really appreciate all the work the news team has been putting in. So thank you so much, Connor. We have a good show coming up for you today, a nice packed Thursday wire. If I akine, I speak to Virginia Oakley, who is the early childhood rep on the national executive for NZEI, Te Reo, the government, about the government's support package for early childhood educators during COVID-19 restrictions. Connor speaks to Zoe Canandis from Radio Adelaide for an update on COVID-19 in Australia and news of a new discovery in the Great Barrier Reef. I chat to Susan Thorpe, who is the Cultural Projects Manager at the Moriori Heritage Trust, about reviving the Moriori language. Connor also speaks to NIWA scientist Dr. Sarah Mikloff-Fletcher about climate emissions during lockdown and the future of climate change for New Zealand. And then finally, I talk to Paul Radich, who is the president of the New Zealand Bar Association, about the association's call for the government to provide safe passage for Afghan women, judges and their families to New Zealand. He aho whakaaro. I would love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces. So tukapātui mai, you can send me through a text on 53395, or why Mairane, give me a call in studio on 309-3879. Also, after the show, koua e wariwari e ahi ana koutou, te whakarongo ki enei kōrero anō, he pakihiri rokiroki mā runga i te pae tukutuku o irarangi poho. Mi haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Go to the BCasts page, hit the wire, and you can catch up on all the awesome pieces that have been created remotely during lockdown. So do check that out if you miss anything on the shows. You can also check up with us on our social media. 95BFM News is our handle. We're on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram. We've got a good show coming up for you today, so please stay tuned in. And yeah, let's get through lockdown and get into some news. Love the news.
Irirangi Poho, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Yesterday, Minister for Education Chris Hipkins announced that early childhood teachers and support staff will be able to access free COVID-19 Employee Assistance Program support. This means that early childhood educators will be able to have up to 3 confidential one-on-one counselling sessions online or by phone to support them while COVID-19 restrictions are in place. The funding comes from the $16 million workforce wellbeing package, and the support will be available from the 25th of August 2021 to the 25th of November 2021. Early childhood educators are often in the news because of their continued battle to achieve pay parity with other teachers working in New Zealand. Earlier this month, NZEI Te Reo, the education union, said that they were disappointed with the government's $170 million budget initiative to close the pay gap between kindergarten and early learning centre teachers. They said that the funding falls well short of the increased teacher wage rates for most early childhood centres. According to NZEI Te Reo, it can be simply put that the extra funding offered by the government doesn't equal the increased wage bill. This morning, I spoke to Virginia Oakley, the early childhood rep on the national executive for NZEI Te Reo, about the government's latest support package for early childhood educators to seek counselling while COVID-19 restrictions are in place. We discuss whether the package is enough, considering the sector's constant struggles with pay parity, support for relief staff, and widespread feeling of being undervalued. I began by asking Virginia what NZDI Te Rerua's position is on the government support package.
It's a positive step. It's a good thing because a lot of early childhood teachers don't actually have access to any sort of counselling service. So making this available is a good acknowledgement of the importance of supporting teachers in early childhood education. And I think there's a lot of anxiety and stuff out there too, because as early childhood teachers, we work in close proximity to children. There's fear and anxiety around exposure to COVID. There's concerns around pay, work, people fearing loss of work. Some people getting their hours reduced so that employers can say that they're paying them the full amount, but they just actually reduce their hours. So there's a whole lot of awful stuff, even just the juggling of your home life and trying to work online and stuff like that, or when we go into bubbles, you know, having to expose your children to bubbles so that you can go back to work, that sort of stuff that creates so much anxiety.
Now, I just want to talk about a couple of technicalities with this package. It is accessible for a few months from August 25th through to November 25th and gives the worker three sessions while COVID restrictions are in place. Is this enough?
No, I don't think it's enough. That doesn't acknowledge the fact that the implications of being in COVID might not be happening now. It may be further down the track. For a lot of early childhood teachers, this will be the only opportunity for counselling. It won't be that they'll have access through their own work. I mean, like in our area, pre-COVID, it was taking 3 weeks to even get an appointment with EAP. I don't know what the situation is now. I mean, you know, people react to things at different times and in different ways, and I think that it should be definitely an extended thing.
I suppose that is the thing as well, as COVID-19 has been going on for almost 2 years. So have early childhood educators felt supported by the government throughout the pandemic, or is this the first response in that period?
I think it varies. I mean, the privatisation of early childhood education, it means created some really unequal situations for teachers across the sector. And I think that's made it really hard for the government to deal with employers and unfair practices. So do early child teachers feel supported? I think the positive is that early child services are still being paid for their current roles. So there's still income coming in. But no, because as I said, that we've got employers doing some really dodgy practices out there with teachers as ways to cut what they pay and stuff like that. People accessing the full subsidy but not passing it on to their workers. And there's some really terrible stories out there. I know us as NZDI have been quite involved in supporting members. We're running sessions on Facebook just trying to let teachers know what their rights are. But there's also another group of early childhood teachers that have just been totally overlooked, and this is our relievers. So in the primary sector, the relievers in primary have been able to get paid through lockdown and based on average of what they've earned over the last 90 days or something like that. So they'll continue to get income, and we can't run without relievers. They are such an important part of our workforce. In early childhood, we don't have that. There is nothing for our early childhood relievers.
I feel like this is quite a common thing, because I've had a few conversations with people working in early childhood education, and this typically seems to be the deal, that teachers for kindergartens or teachers for primary schools are getting paid more, are getting pay for their relief teachers. Just feels like quite a common theme. Why is early childhood education not provided those same rights that other teachers are?
Well, to me, it's historic. It's back on the days where early childhood work was seen as childcare and not education. I mean, we did have our kindergarten teachers, and then we had the childcare sector. And then now we do the same job, which is education and care. And we now also, study and research has shown the importance of the early years and the importance of the learning that's going on. But as a society, it just doesn't seem to be valued. I mean, I think you talk to any parent that's got a child in early child education, they want the best for their children. But I think that as a society, we just don't. There just doesn't seem to be the value. I had an interview a couple months ago where someone said, why should we get paid more than a physics teacher? And I was like, well, because a child won't learn physics if we haven't got it right in the early years, if we haven't got the pre-literacy and pre-numeracy skills in place. Also, too, I think early child education is not compulsory, and I think that when something becomes compulsory, it kind of lifts the status. I know, too, years ago when the Labor government were working towards having 100% qualified teachers and they were working towards pay parity and stuff, the status of early child education actually lifted with the pay. And then when the national government came in and they slashed that funding, that you could feel the loss, that people just, you know, almost like society shifted their views along with that.
I finally just want to talk a little bit about pay parity, because this is an issue that pops up quite a lot when it comes to early childhood education. So do you think this latest announcement for counselling during COVID-19 for early childhood workers, does that perhaps gloss over the long-term call for pay parity?
I mean, I guess it could. I mean, I think it highlights the inequities in the system between early childhood and the rest of the sector. I think that's really sort of highlighted. I mean, we need it. It's the number of people going into train as early childhood teachers has dropped. We have high retirement happening. We've got an ageing workforce. I mean, you can go and work as a teacher aide in schools and get paid more than our teachers at the bottom of the scale. That's just not okay. And we've got teachers 20 years experience that are still sitting at that minimum amount, which I think is now around about $24 an hour. It is a skilled job. It really is. I mean, people might not think it, but you know, when you're working with a group of children and you've got to make sure that every single one of those children feels recognised and supported, and you're supporting their learning and trying to find out what they're passionate about and trying to create programs to support that. You're trying to teach children to be able to work and play along with other children. You're trying to teach them to be able to follow instructions and, as I said, tracking left to right. There is so much that we do. You know, it's time for society, you know, it's time for the government to actually step up and pay all teachers equally and recognise the importance of the job that we do.
That was Virginia Oakley, who is the Early Childhood Representative on the National Executive for NZEI, Te Rūrua, talking a little bit about the government's support package for early childhood educators during COVID-19 restrictions, and then going on to talk a little bit more about the struggles with pay parity for the early childhood education sector. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm your host today, holding the reins for the news team while we go through this lockdown period. If you have any thoughts on the pieces I've played on the show today, send me through a text. 5395 is the number, or give me a call in studio. 309 3879 is the phone number, so you can call me and have a chat. We'll be back after a wee break.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. How to exercise at alert level 4. You can still exercise, but only if you're alone or with people in your bubble. Remember to stay within your neighborhood and keep at least 2 meters away from others. Playgrounds are closed. You should also avoid places where people may gather. Make sure you avoid any exercise that could require emergency services if you got into trouble, like surfing or tramping. Unite against COVID-19.
All right. Spot time, I reckon.
Yo, keen. Got any utensils? We'll sacrifice some, eh? We're going to need a vessel too. I'll scale the last of the sparkling to it.
Wait.
Yes, yeah, spot's on.
Whoa, no, I mean the beer spot, you know? Amazing, independent, NZ beer.
Ah, oh, the legal buzz. Okay, yeah, gotcha. Yeah, I knew you meant that. It's just... Yeah.
95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry. A fully legal 3-hour psychedelic playground of japes, jives and jams. 4 to 7 p.m. every weekday on 95BFM. Thanks to the Beer Spot, your tappy place.
You call that a news update? This is a news update. It's Neighbourhood Watch.
You're back on 95BFM. This is The Wire, and it is time for Neighbourhood Watch. Today, Connor speaks to Zoe Canandes from Radio Adelaide for an update on the state of the pandemic throughout Australia. They then discuss a new 400-year-old coral found in the Great Barrier Reef. Connor began the interview by asking what the current state of the lockdown was in Australia.
I'll give you a little rundown of state by state. So, obviously, we have the front runners in New South Wales. yesterday, they unfortunately recorded 919 locally acquired cases of COVID-19, which is a new record, a new daily record here in Australia. And it is quite unbelievable to think that's happening a year and a half after we thought the initial kind of outbreak was happening. Again, we've unfortunately seen two deaths that were confirmed yesterday morning. A woman in her 30s from Western Sydney and a man in his 80s who acquired his infection at the Greenwood Aged Care Facility in Normanhurst. And this is devastatingly the third death that is linked to that aged care facility. So that's New South Wales at the moment. And then we're seeing Victoria has recorded 45 new locally acquired cases of coronavirus. Majority of those were in isolation for the entire infectious period. So there's a little bit of good news, I suppose. And then we look to the other states, we can see that the ACT has recorded a few more cases in the community, a total of, so they had 9 new cases, now they have a total of 30. They're still in lockdown. And then we're seeing Western Australia and South Australia. As of midnight last night, we are able to free travel between the two states of Western and South Australia. We don't really have any cases. The only cases that we've been recording have just been hotel quarantine who have come from overseas. And then Queensland has recorded no new coronavirus cases. So that's sort of a bit of an overview of us all here in Australia.
Is it strange to feel half your country is locked down while the other half is free to move, as you've said?
Yeah, it really is very strange. And you, when you're not in lockdown, so like me and all the other South Australians, you feel like you kind of forget a little bit. You just sort of forget about the global pandemic and you can live your life every day somewhat normally. And you kind of do get this very large sense of guilt, knowing that other states are completely in lockdown and, you know, we're not going to see New South Wales out of lockdown for a really long time. It's a really strange feeling and it's hard to explain. And I feel awful, obviously, for especially Victoria and New South Wales. Victoria having been in lockdown now over 200 days. Yeah, it feels really bizarre. I can't really articulate it properly, but yeah, it feels very strange.
Have there been any estimates as to when it's going to die down for New South Wales and Victoria?
It's hard to say. We're seeing a lot of schools start to close down in New South Wales now as well, and it feels like it's getting, obviously with 900 new cases in a day, they're going to have to become a bit more extreme. However, in saying that, the vaccine rollout, which I've spoken about before to you all, has been a really interesting, it's been very interesting to watch how the government have decided to roll out our vaccines. But currently, the Pfizer or AZ will be available. I think it's hard to even keep up and know. But for example, here in South Australia, the AZ and the Pfizer are now available to people over the age of 16. And you can book in. That happened last week. We were all allowed to book our vaccines. So the rollout is speeding up a bit, and especially between those, you know, highly mobile 16 to 39 year old age group who, you know, are in the carriers or transmitting this disease throughout the community, that we're finally able to get vaccinated. So it's exciting, and the vaccine rollout is finally starting to sort of kick up a bit. And for example, I'll be fully vaccinated by October, which is something I wasn't certainly expecting a few months ago. I thought it was going to be next year that I would have had the opportunity. So, you know, these outbreaks, if anything, have really kicked up the vaccine, and that's a good thing, I suppose.
Yeah. Okay. Now, moving on, there has been this new discovery in the Great Barrier Reef. Do you want to tell me a bit about this?
Yeah, some good news, I'd say. So there's been a discovery of this huge coral, and it's more than 400 years old in the Great Barrier Reef. And to think that something could survive in the Great Barrier Reef for 400 years is incredible, considering, I mean, climate change, cyclones, bleaching, all these awful things that happened to the reef, and the fact that we all know the Great Barrier Reef is certainly dying. Researchers and snorkelers, I suppose, have found this massive coral that is 400 years old, and the country loves it so much. It's so exciting. It's the size of a small building, which is unreal. It's kind of magnificent. I certainly would recommend looking up photos. It's located in a quite remote and rarely visited area in the marine. And it was found during citizen science research in March this year. And then they found out it was 400 years old. And it's just sort of this really exciting coral. And I know, I mean, it's just such good news. It's just good to know that the Great Barrier Reef can be so resilient, even under threat. As I mentioned, like the bleaching of the Great Barrier Reef, it's abhorrent and devastating for our country. But now we have this big, massive coral that's 400 years old. And it's given just a little bit of hope, I think, to everyone. And who knows? I mean, the Great Barrier Reef, I found this out yesterday, it's like 2,000 kilometres long. I had no idea. It's massive. So, you know, we don't know if there's more coral that is as old or as big, but there's so much to discover, which is really exciting.
That was Zoe Canandis from Radio Adelaide speaking to Connor about COVID-19 in Australia and the new coral discovery in the Great Barrier Reef.
That was Neighbourhood Watch. Ripper.
You're on the wire on 95BFM. Do send me through a text. 5395 is the number if you have any thoughts on the pieces on the show today, or if you just want to tell me how you're going. I'm always interested to hear, so do text through. Right, I have another piece coming up from Connor. So here we go. Global climate change goals have been set at an increase of 1.5 degrees Celsius by the year 2030, a goal that looks pretty unattainable. But could lockdowns be the answer to reaching these goals? Last year's lockdown definitely points in that direction, so Connor decided to investigate. Connor spoke to NIWA scientist Dr. Sarah Mikloff-Fletcher about how last year's lockdown impacted New Zealand's climate change efforts. He then reflected on our current lockdown and discussed what New Zealand needs to do in order to meet climate change goals. Connor began the interview by asking what our emissions were like during last year's lockdown.
So the emissions in the 2020 lockdown for New Zealand reduced really dramatically. In fact, an international study that compared emissions of carbon dioxide across every nation on Earth, led by the Global Carbon Project, showed that New Zealand's emissions dropped more than any other country except for Luxembourg, which is a tiny nation in Europe. And the reason for that big drop, it was probably partly because our lockdown was much, much stricter than most other places. So this study was comparing the peak lockdowns of all of those places. And our lockdown, which was much stricter than most places. But on top of that, over 80% of our stationary power generation, which means the power you use to do the things you mostly do in lockdown, which is heat your house and cook your meals and, you know, run your electronics, more than 80% of that is on renewables. So that means if you can knock traffic on the head, you can really go a long way to reduce emissions. So that international study suggested that New Zealand's emissions reduced by 41%. And then at the same time, through some collaborations we have with GNS Science and our Carbon Watch program, we did a lot of measurements of CO2 at roadsides and greenhouse gas emissions at roadsides. And in urban areas, those showed that traffic emissions reduced by 75 to 80%, which is a pretty good fit with the traffic count data from Waka Kotahi. So that's all painting a picture of a really big emissions reduction just during that short period. But then if you look across the year last year, and you look at the Statistics New Zealand numbers about what our emissions look like across the year, that emission reduction was actually quite small. It was only around 5%. And there are a few different reasons for that. One reason for that is that our lockdown was short and sharp compared to a lot of other places. And afterwards, things pretty much went back to normal. So as a result, then our emissions bounced back as well. The second reason is that those numbers I was talking about, those numbers all focused on CO2. And CO2 is only half the story in Aotearoa, New Zealand. A lot of our emissions are methane, which comes primarily from agriculture. And those were pretty steady during lockdown as well. Those didn't change very much during lockdown. And then the third reason is in the second half of last year, there was a lot of drought across Aotearoa. And as a result, our ability to generate power from generate hydropower was really compromised. So we had extra emissions in the second half of the year from that impact. So the net emissions reductions across the year, only about 5%, unfortunately. So, but any emissions reduction you can do is great. However, that kind of one-off big emissions reduction, it doesn't do a whole lot for climate overall. If we want to stay below 1.5 degrees warming, which is, you know, the stated goal of our carbon zero legislation, as well as the Paris Agreement, if we want to stay below 1.5 degrees warming, we have to reduce our emissions by 7% a year, every single year, in this decade, essentially.
So, yeah, I just want to go off some of those things you said. So obviously the 75 to 80% traffic emissions reduction isn't sustainable. And the sort of shortness of our lockdown only had a very little effect over the whole annual timeframe. Can you go into sort of more detail of sort of what changes we do need to be making to make a bigger impact on our climate change?
In order to make a sustained change, we need not just an emergency short-term change in response to a humanitarian crisis. We need a planned change that's, you know, thought of in detail ahead of time and implemented with as quickly as possible. And that's really the role of the Climate Change Commission, is to identify and make recommendations around plans and how we should change our emission, what steps we should take to change our emissions to meet the goals of the legislation.
So with NIWA's current findings, can we say that we're on track with meeting those goals, or is there still a lot of room for us to improve?
I mean, at this moment, we're not on track to meet our goals, either nationally or globally, to reduce emissions enough to avoid 1.5 degrees warming.
What kind of figures do we need to be seeing in order to say that, yes, we are on track?
We need to be looking at an emissions reduction of around 7% a year, every year over this decade.
You said that last year we were at 5%, is that correct?
Yes.
And that was even with the big decrease due to our lockdown?
Yes, even with the big decrease. But I mean, you have to think about where we're at in our process. Where we're at in our process is the Climate Commission has made some recommendations. So first we set our goals, then the Climate Commission made some recommendations, and now it's really on the government to, you know, put in place a whole lot of policy to back up those recommendations. And that Climate Commission recommendations, they're really only freshly out in the last couple of months.
Do you see any of the same results happening because of our current lockdown as we saw last year?
Where we're at right now is that we're in level four now. So we do have a series of instruments that are in place around the city of Auckland as part of our Carbon Watch project. And this is through a collaboration with Jocelyn Turnbull and her team at GNS Science. And those instruments will be measuring changes in CO2 in the Auckland environment due to lockdown. And we also have another program to measure what's going on in lockdown, which is called the Great New Zealand Grass Off. You can check it out online if you're interested. And the idea of that program is that that fossil fuel emissions depleted in the radioactive isotope in carbon, because fossil fuels are very, very old, right? And so when you have a lot of fossil fuels in the atmosphere, grasses that grow very quickly, they absorb that radiocarbon depleted carbon, and you can see that in the grass. And so this is an activity that's actually safe to do during lockdown, is people can go out and take a little grass clipping and save it in their freezer and then send it in to our partners at GNS Science once it's safe to do so. And then after the fact, they can do those measurements. So right at this present moment, I cannot say that exactly what the changes have been, because it's not safe to collect all our measurements and do some of the work we need to do on that. But a lot of things are in place that we'll be able to make some pretty clear comments on what the impacts were of this present lockdown, you know, a little bit down the track when it's safe to reopen, get back into our laboratory and do our measurements. In a sense, as a client, as a scientist who uses atmospheric measurements to infer, you know, how much emissions have changed or how much carbon's been absorbed by forests, something like a lockdown is a pretty exciting opportunity, because it's a chance to really show that we can detect the changes that we're going to be called upon to detect in the future when people are taking serious action on climate change.
Do you have anything else you want to add to our climate change targets and outputs currently?
If you think about the massive effort and disruption that it took to do lockdown last year and to be in lockdown now, and then you reflect on how little the impact of emissions was on emissions, it's really easy to lose heart, especially when you think about also how quickly the window of time is closing during which we can make a real difference on climate change. But I would encourage your listeners to also consider that even though that window is narrowing and that effort was tremendous, not to lose heart, because there still is a lot we can do through more planned systemic change. The window of time we have to do that in order to, you know, meet goals of limiting warming to only 1.5 degrees, that window of time is very, very short, but it's still possible with much active systemic change. It's more planned. So I would just encourage everyone not to throw up their hands and walk away. And also to take home the message that even if we can't keep warming below 1.5 degrees, every bit of warming we're able to avoid will contribute to us having the better future that I want for myself and for my children as well.
That was NIWA scientist Dr. Sarah McLaugh-Fletcher speaking to Connor about climate change during lockdown and the future of climate change efforts.
I don't know how to say this. Betula Goose star?
You're not a child of the 80s. If you were, you would know the film with a similar name. The star is Beetlejuice.
Oh.
Yeah.
The Wire.
Tāria Moriori is the language of the Moriori people. The first Moriori ancestors travelled hundreds of years ago from eastern Polynesia to Rikohu, which is what is known now as the Chatham Islands more broadly. The language Tāria Moriori is similar to Te Reo Māori and other Pacific Island languages, but it is truly unique and a true source of cultural heritage for the descendants of the Moriori that are alive today. The last fluent speakers passed away in the very early 1900s, but a lot of work has been done before this happened to protect Tāria Moriori and has been done since to revive it. Last week, the Ministry of Education released 5 stories on their website that are written completely in Tāria Moriori. I wanted to speak to someone about how this initiative came to be. I contacted the Hokotihi Moriori Heritage Trust and interviewed Susan Thorpe, who is the Cultural Projects Manager at the Trust, about the Ministry of Education resources, but also more widely about reviving the Moriori language. We also talked about the aspirations of Moriori to have the language and the history of the people to be better understood here in Aotearoa New Zealand and across the world. To begin with, the big question, could you briefly explain the history of the Moriori language and its people?
Of course. course. So Moriori migrated directly to Chatham Islands, and the name for the Chathams here is Rekohu, which means misty sun, directly from eastern Polynesia, probably about 800 years ago. And that direct migration brought with them their languages and traditions and artistic styles directly from their homelands, probably somewhere in the southern Tahiti, Austral Island group. And indeed, that's where we have the most common language similarities. So the language is similar to Te Reo Māori, similar to Kuki Airani, Kanaka Hawaii, and so on, but actually also has many differences as well, not just dialectical, but quite strong differences in terms of pronunciation and, in fact, words.
Now, I understand that the last fluent speakers passed away in the early 1900s. How is Te Ra Moriori used today if those fluent speakers are gone now?
Jemima, you're correct to say that the last fluent speakers probably passed away around about 1900, 1902. But even before then, they were speaking a kind of hybridised Moriori Te Reo Māori, because Moriori had been enslaved for decades and prevented from speaking their own language. So even by 1900, the language was changing quite a lot. But fortunately, we have written archival sources, including an extraordinary bilingual partition written in 1862 by Moriori survivors, 130 pages, in Moriori and in Māori. We have those references, and we have many other written sources from the late 1800s. So that's been the basis for the revival project.
Let's talk a little bit about the revival of Moriori and what the aspirations are when it comes to having the language more widely spoken or taught in schools, or what is sort of the goals when it comes to reviving the language?
Well, firstly, I want to acknowledge those Moriori ancestors who had extraordinary vision back in 1862 to go about writing down as much as they could. I mean, it's just amazing, and the gift that they've given us is incredible. So those early archivists must in some way have known that they had to protect these beautiful treasures. So our aspirations are for all New Zealanders to be aware that there is another language in our country. So our official languages here are, in fact, we've only got two official languages, Te Reo Māori and sign language. English is a de facto formal language, but not officially a language here. So we would like people to realise that there's yet another language that can be spoken in these islands, and to have Tāre Moriori revived in our homes, of course at our marae here on Rekohu, and to have the beauty and the diversity of our language understood. I strongly believe that language is connected with identity, and if you can speak your language or even parts of your language, you have a closer affiliation with your cultural identity.
Now, does that, the way that the language exists today, I know you spoke earlier about it having merged a little bit with Te Reo Māori, going forward, is it likely that that will continue to happen to make perhaps people's learning or their understanding of Te Reo Moriori easier, perhaps coming from a Te Reo Māori background?
No, I hope not. We're working hard to preserve its distinctiveness using those old archival sources. The sort of hybridisation was happening in the late 1800s, but we're going back earlier than that to stay as true as we can to the original language, and reviving almost on a daily basis the beautiful words. There's about 30 words that I know of to describe the dawn and the sunrise. So, you know, those wow. indicators of how important that was here Well, probably given our weather, that's not surprising. So we've developed a language app that's for Android phones at the moment. We have these beautiful short stories published, thanks to the Ministry of Education, on their online portal for learning te reo Māori, but they recognise that Tāori and Moriori had a place there, which is, we're very grateful for that. And we worked with a team at Cognition Education and with our very talented translator, Kiwa Hammond, to bring these Tāori and Moriori stories to life.
Fantastic. And I just wanted to touch a little bit more on those resources that have recently been published on the Ministry of Education website. How did that process sort of come to be? Is the Ministry of Education, did they approach the Trust or was that sort of a group effort?
The Ministry approached Hokotihi Moriori Trust in the first instance because they had become aware through some of our discussions about promoting Moriori identity and culture through the school journals, that there was a distinctive gap in the records. So it was the Ministry's encouragement and respect for Tāori and Moriori that saw this happen. And then we devised a metaphor for looking at how we would structure these resources. So Moriori have a beautiful cosmology that describes the separation of heavens and earth using 10 pillars. And we've used this as a metaphor for building our language from the ground upwards. So there's 5 stories now and 5 more to come shortly, comprising the full 10 pillars to rebuild our beautiful language.
I suppose a really cool thing that potentially might happen as well is with the government's initiative to have New Zealand history taught in all schools. Do you think there's a place for the history of the Moriori people and the language to be fed in through there as well?
There's undoubtedly a place for Moriori history and culture to be taught in all our schools. We've actually had to fight quite hard for that recognition, and the fight's ongoing. It's not just a local story, it's a truth that needs to be taught in all of our schools, and our education curriculum would be the better for it. The story of Moriori culture and identity and what happened down here on the Chathams is, there's a lot of myths around it, and it's actually spectacularly invisible in our current curriculum. And in many New Zealanders' minds, so often when we get some kind of social media discussion about Moriori history or culture, suddenly there's a rush of commentators on Twitter or Reddit or Facebook or wherever denying Moriori even exist or saying things like, nope, they're just another Māori tribe. And these are the kinds of myths we definitely want to eradicate.
Just one final thing, when it comes to the resources that are available on the Ministry of Education website, and I'm sure other resources that are available through the Heritage Trust, could you speak about why it's important to have these sort of resources available for all people to access?
Well, some of the core Moriori values are based on inclusivity, sharing and peacemaking. So our view is, We want to share our beautiful culture and language with the world, with anyone who would show any interest in learning this. In fact, some of the greatest interest we've had is from international audiences. So we know that there's a passion for learning about what's quite possibly the oldest language spoken in New Zealand territorial waters.
That was Susan Thorpe, the Cultural Projects Manager at the Hokotihi Moriori Heritage Trust, speaking about efforts to revive Tāori Moriori, the language of the Moriori people. We touched on the recent publication of 5 books written entirely in Tāori Moriori on the Ministry of Education website. If you are interested in reading them or having a wee look, please do head to Ko Whatareo, which is KAU. At whatareo www.govt.nz, and then you can head to a resources page, and the resource you're looking for is Ka Kakipunga Korero, which is awesome. So the books are beautifully illustrated and are a really important resource for the language revival, and in my opinion, it would make a very great lazy lockdown day activity. So do absolutely take a look. And thank you so much, Susan, for her time this morning. You're tuned into The Wire on 95BFM. I'm Jemima. I'm your host. I've got the reins at the moment while the news team is working hard at home in lockdown. I've been talking too much for the last week. We'll be back right after a little break with one last piece for you.
This is a COVID-19 announcement. Getting tested at alert level 4. Testing helps identify cases in the community. You should isolate and get tested if you visited a location of interest on the day and at the time listed, or have cold or flu symptoms, or are a contact of a known case. Call Healthline or your GP for more advice about when to get a COVID-19 test. Unite against COVID-19.
It's music.
95.
We're an underground radio station here. And we bring the truth.
Residency. Probably riding past some boundaries so effortlessly.
The original originator. Go to 95bfm.com for show podcasts.
This is a sad, sad day. BFM, the font of liberalism and tolerance at the centre of the University of Auckland.
The Wire.
You're back on 95BFM and The Wire. Gosh, that sting always makes me laugh a little. Anyway, we've got one last piece for you. The New Zealand Bar Association is calling for the New Zealand government to ensure safe passage and refuge for Afghan women judges and their families stuck in the latest Afghanistan crisis with the takeover of the Taliban. They're backing the initial call, which was made by the International Association of Women Judges. This morning, I spoke to Paul Radich, who is the president of the New Zealand Bar Association, about the association's call and why it is so important for these women judges to be given safe passage. Here is Paul now. To begin with, what is the New Zealand Bar Association calling for when it comes to women judges in Afghanistan?
Well, what we're looking for, Jemima, is as much international help as there can be. Now, we know that it's difficult for New Zealand directly to become involved because the US have reached the point where their airlifts are starting to wrap up. New Zealand is slowing down on the processing of visas. But what we're looking to do through the International Association of Women Judges is to join with their call for there to be funds provided for them, because they have an international approach to this in mind. The Afghan women judges are really in desperate need, and they're looking at safe and fair ways of applying the funds to get them out to different countries or to provide other measures to support them. And so I think the key is here at the moment for us to look to the IAJW donations page, and you can find that through their website, which is just iawj.org. And the efforts are being coordinated, as I say, internationally.
As you said right in the beginning, you said it is quite a big ask for New Zealand to ensure that safe passage, particularly as, you know, it was reported earlier this morning that 10,000 people were waiting at the Kabul airport in Afghanistan. And it doesn't necessarily appear from the images that we're seeing and the reports that we're seeing that evacuations are happening in an orderly fashion. So how is it possible to pick people out and get them that safe passage?
Yeah, and I think that you're right, and that's why it's very difficult for us to do it from where we sit, and why the International Association of Women Judges is a very good way to go about it, because that association has strong links with the Afghan women judges. They've been well connected with our conferences this year. 37 of the Afghan women judges attended remotely the International Association of Women Judges that was hosted in Auckland, because the chair at the moment is Justice Glazebrook, a judge from our Supreme Court and a fabulous person in terms of the work that she's doing with this effort. And the Afghan women judges had a material part in that conference, and they forged very strong connections there. In fact, in 2013, we hosted six judges from Afghanistan. They came here, they visited our courts and organisations. So through the International Association, there are direct links, and there are, as I say, international efforts to be able to get them out, not just through New Zealand, but at an international level.
Why is it so important that these Afghan women judges have safe passage? Why is the focus there?
Yeah, and the reality is that there are so many people in Afghanistan who are at severe risk. It is a deeply concerning situation. So many people generally, so many that have helped the New Zealand effort there while we were there with our PRT and in Kabul, the judiciary generally. The reason for the focus on women in particular is that they have been targeted specifically. There were two women who were assassinated on their way to work in mid-January, killed by unidentified workmen. The women judges are facing threats now from unidentified people. The reality is that it's considered, from the Taliban perspective, unacceptable for women to sit in judgment over men. And they have in the past, of course, made some quite significant rulings in criminal cases, anti-corruption, family courts matters. The Taliban have released prisoners from high security prisons at the moment, and the judges, as we understand it, are receiving calls with threats to them. And so the focus on women judges is for that reason, that these are people that the international community really focused on taking office to try and establish a rule of law situation in Afghanistan, and for them now to be facing these severe daily risks is something that's of deep concern to us as we look at the rule of law and the importance of a safe and independent judiciary.
That was Paul Radich, who is the president of the New Zealand Bar Association, talking about the association backing the calls of the International Association of Women Judges by calling for the New Zealand government to provide safe passage for Afghan women judges and their families out of Afghanistan. Apologies for the beginning of that interview with me telling you that Paul's sound check was good. It's lockdown and there's something funny about today. But anyway, we're at the end of the show.
That was The Wire.
That was the Thursday Wire for another week. Thank you very much to all of you for tuning in and sending us through your texts and giving me a call. I always love to hear your thoughts and feedback, so absolutely keep doing that, particularly through this lockdown time. I know it can be a bit lonely and a bit funny, so do let us know how you're going. And if you have any thoughts on the Wire pieces that we produce for you throughout this time. Huge thank you to Connor for producing the show today. Such an awesome effort to create a fully produced pieces from home. This is Connor's first time doing lockdown with the news team, and that's his second show producing for The Wire. So massive shout out to Connor. And then, as I've been saying every day, a big, big thank you to the news team who continue to amaze me and make me so proud with all the work that they're doing from home as well. We're bringing you 8 bulletins today and an hour-long current affairs show Monday to Friday, and it's just amazing that all of my lovely news teamers are keeping on. And again, a huge thank you to the wider BFM team for sticking it out and getting us through this lockdown period. Up next is the 1 to 4. I hope you have a lovely afternoon. Stay tuned in to BFM, and yeah, stay safe out there, everyone. Ka kite anō.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.